This is Brock and Salk.
Brock Huard is my hero.
What Brock Huard says?
No, he's not a friend of mine.
Subscribe to receive every episode at Apple Podcasts or on Google Podcasts.
Ah, we stink, man.
Now, here are your hosts, Brock Huard and Mike Salk.
No way!
Well, here we go, Brock. We got another Brock and Salk podcast, different from last week. Couple reasons. One, I'm going to kind of hold your feet to the fire today. Not going to lie.
Ooh, accountability.
Yeah, there'll be some accountability.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, we're not going to let
business?
Well, stuff's just not going to slide, all right? I think we've been letting stuff slide for too long.
Okay.
So I'd like to kind of hold your feet to the fire today. Second of all, perhaps you hear those other chuckles behind me.
Wow.
We got a full house in here today. Kyle
to
my left.
The boys are back again. The boys are back again.
I've got Howdy to my right. Howdy back from the dead. Yeah, we've got a full group here today.
Was it just you and me last week?
Huh?
It was just you and me last week.
It was just
week,
you and
right?
me. I had to like do all the technical genius.
Yeah.
I was really nervous about all that. I set you up, I hit record, and I thought, well, we're never going to see that audio.
And yet it worked out perfectly.
He posted it to the podcast page. He did all sorts of analytics on it.
I'm an intuitive genius, and I would say better than Howdy.
And you had to go back and like delete the first 15 minutes.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, Brock and I talked about some stuff that you could not.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, geez, I think Kyle pressed record. Like, we're going to delete all that. So, yeah, I mean, like, we'd get fired. Like, people would lose their jobs all over the city based on what we were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So, it was high level stuff, super high level. So, as Howdy likes to say, that's a Howdy phrase, right? Have you ever heard Howdy say that? Oh, it's kind of high level stuff.
I imagine it was mainly just Mike talking about Phoenix,
talking
about Culver's, talking about his outfits, talking about his driver.
Well, Brock did come out with the idea. That was Brock's idea to put together my kit for the weekend.
I'd call that sabotage.
That is definitely sabotage.
You think
he
Brock
set
know.
You up to get, he teed you up like you teed up your driver.
Mike, no, people would love it. You should really do that. No, that would be great.
I loved it. I thought it was great. And then I'll have you know. That my last day there, I went with the sort of white and light gray. This the starter was like thought we was like, oh, you guys playing from the tips? I was like,
man,
no,
you got a nice belt. You must be like a two handicap.
He's like, I don't think so. He's like, well, you're all dressed like you kind of got the look going. I was like, well, you know, look good, feel good, play good. And he's like, well, you look like very very fit. Like you look
wow.
like you're ready to go.
Hey.
Which
wow.
made me feel like the whole you thing was good. Worthwhile, except yeah. the fact that guy was at least 85.
And he's wow. Yeah, and he slipped you a business card on the way out, too.
No, he just, you know, he was an old man. Like, that's sort of how that goes. So,
was that your roughest round? You had one you said you didn't want to talk about.
I don't want to talk about the round at Quintero. Didn't happen. I may have had a legitimate full-on temper tantrum on the course.
Oh. See, that's the double-edged sword, as you said. You know, it's great to be with my college buddies. I can just be myself. But then, really, you get in that moment, and there's no holds barred.
I had so much fun down there. We had a great time. And I played not great throughout the entire weekend, but at times fine. Had a nice birdie and a par three, which is always fun. But, I lost it for like 10 holes
because
in a row.
Of others, because of slow play, or
I blame
solely
yourself.
Self-induced.
Well, so I'll take you a little more inside.
Where are the
inside.
Officials at? Where, tell me about the officials.
Let me take you inside. So I was in a cart with Nate. So of all my friends, I love Nate. He's best man at my wedding, etc. But he gets under my skin in a way that no one else I know does.
Oh, good.
He legitimately knows how, like,
more
I think,
than Howdy?
It's a man after my own heart.
It's not even close. It's not even close. No one in my life has ever gotten... So I should never introduce you guys, because like if you get Nate's tips of the trade, I'm done. He can get under my skin like no one I've ever met. And it's like, it's right from... It's like, well, so, you know, he wants to play from farther back. And I'm like, well, dude, like... One of these guys who we're playing with has never broken 100. I don't know whether we need to play at 6,800 yards in the desert. And he's like, oh, come on. Like, we're going to go do this. And then it's like, you know, no gimmies, no, like, it's everything.
Oh, no. No mulligans.
No mullies, no gimmies, no this, no that.
Like,
so he's just like fully just like, he just, and he knows how to like completely needle it. And so, and he and I are in a cart together, and we start off, and Nate makes us play back a tee from probably where anybody except for maybe him should have been.
Mm.
I mean, he's a pretty good golfer. Credit to him. He's at a country club. He's a pretty good golfer. But, like, you know, we come up, and all four of us duff into the woods. I'm like, dude, could we, this is ridiculous. And so it sort of escalated from there, and he's like, dude, I just want to see you hit your driver. Why aren't you hitting your driver? Why didn't you hit your driver? Like, I can't hit it. Nate, I can't hit the driver. And so it ends up with me just like cursing him out and screaming at him. And full on temper tantrum on like the 13th or 14th hole at Quintero.
It's the making you explain things that you feel you've already made clear.
Right.
That's one thing that you really like. Have we talked about this, Nate? Have I told you about the driver?
You were talking about getting your feet held to the fire.
Oh, it's awful.
He was really doing it to you.
I've known him since my first day of college. We've been good friends since then. So anyway. It was, they had its moments, Brock, but there were some challenges along the way before we finally got done. But we had a blast. Played 36 for the first time in my life. You ever done that? Played 36 in a day? I'd never done it.
Yeah. Ooh,
we got to the course for a 7:50 tee time and left it dark. We just finished the last hole of the
day. I hope that wasn't your Quintero blow up.
No.
Because
no,
that second
that
would have
been too much. Ugh. No. That was the next day, thankfully. But I want to hold your feet to the fire today, Brock. It's time.
Like Nate holds yours to the fire.
Yeah, I'm going
That's maybe a perfect little segue.
Yes.
That was the impetus to this actual conversation.
He knows how to needle you.
He does.
He knows how to hold you accountable. No mulligans.
Nope.
No gimmies.
Nope.
We're going to play from these tips. So right. I see what you're doing here. That was Machiavellian. You tell that whole story.
Uh-huh.
So now you can try to do the same to me. Try to get my face flushed. You know it. You can feel it. You can see the vein in my neck start to pump.
Yep.
You know exactly how to get my ire as well. So
I'd be willing to bet I don't even need to participate in the next half hour of the conversation. You can just sort of know where I'm about to go. Oh, but Brock, I'll just ask you this. How do we get here at UW? How did we get here? Because it was not that long ago. They were in the Peach Bowl. I was there. I witnessed it with my own eyes. They were in the Peach Bowl. They were looking to upset Alabama heading into the half before an unfortunate couple of plays kind of took them out of it. And all I heard was how bright the future was. And the recruits that they get based on this, and college football is all about
winning begets winning.
Right. Once you win more, and perception becomes reality, and the caliber of recruits goes up, and the national look at recruiting, and building the fence around Washington, and everything looked up for the program. And since then, they could not have gone farther in the opposite direction. This year is maybe not the 0-12 year of 2008. But it's in some ways more embarrassing just based on everything that's happened and where they were not that long ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I ask you, Brock, what the heck happened? How did we get here?
So you passed along my number to Adam Rittenberg after I passed along Adam Rittenberg's number to you.
That's true.
Kind of a strange little twist here. And he
kind of a power broker in the college football world.
Pretty much, yeah. You're pretty much an information broker. Yeah. The Jay Glazer of college football, you and Bruce Feldman. He asked me the same thing, and I did not necessarily think of it when I answered it yesterday or the day before. But honestly, as you teed that up, and because you teed up the Bamulance, the Alabamulance that you hung out in, I believe, pregame.
I do remember the Alabamulance. I did not hang out in it, but I did.
You and I, man, I believe. Hanging out, having a time.
Iman.
Oh, dude, yeah, that's right. Iman.
How fun was that segment that entire month?
It was great.
To that
it was
game?
So much fun.
So fun. I didn't think about this then, and we just kind of got into, and I'm sure we will unwind this, and Jimmy Lake will come about, and in the recruiting, and all the things that I've shared before. But honestly, as you set that up, and you're right, I did say all of those things. And as you look around college football, I think I could make a pretty good case for all the places that winning does beget winning at Ohio State, at Clemson, at Alabama, right? These places that have seen success, and it propels more success.
At Oregon,
yeah, I think with Mario right now, that in the recruiting classes he's putting together after wins. And remember, it wasn't just a semifinal. It was a New Year's Six game and another New Year's Six game. And quite honestly, I think in order to answer that question, I think we have to tackle this one. Why did Chris Peterson become so disenfranchised with college football that he walked away? Why did Chris Peterson, who had this job, right, who turned down so many jobs for so long when he was at Boise, and pointed to this job and said, yep, this is a good one. I heard Yogi Roth on with you this week, and he talked about this. I've heard from some coaches that have said, yeah, outside of SC, this is the number two job on the West Coast. I mean, obviously, Oregon's its own entity with Nike and everything else, and that's not available. But of all the ones that could become available and throw Oregon in the mix, it's one of the top three jobs. Right, and west of the Mississippi or west of the Rocky Mountains,
like
or whatever.
I like the way you said it. It's basically your way of saying it's right behind Oregon, but without saying it.
Well, Oregon has a support system that is
Oregon's the second best job in the West Coast.
Yes.
Right. That makes Washington the third best job in the West Coast.
You could almost say Oregon being the first job as far as where USC goes, right? Or because of the resources they have, the money they have, the commitment that Phil Knight has made to it, you could probably make a case and argue that. Now, they don't have the history of SC or even the history of Washington, but where they currently stand and with the resources in playing college football. So, I don't know how to answer that question of why Chris Peterson walked away, why he became so disenfranchised with the entire game, the entire recruiting, the whole deal to be able to walk away from this job. He has said to me that, you know what, he felt like life was passing him by, that, you know, all this is going on and he's got such blinders on, he's not enjoying any of it. So he walks away from it. So I think in order to understand where we are now, And you can hold me to the fire all you want.
Has anyone else ever done that?
Totally walked away?
Yeah. I mean, I can't really think of anybody.
I mean, Urban Meyer has.
No, he didn't. Stop it, Brock.
For help
today
purposes.
Is about accountability, so please do not even try that.
I mean,
stop.
Bob Stoops was in his
50s. Bob Stoops would be close.
Okay.
But Bob Stoops, I think, was even older than Chris Peterson, I think. But Bob Stoops would probably be the one at Oklahoma. And then he handed off to a guy that he fully believed in Lincoln Riley, that would carry it on. And all they've done is win six straight Big 12 titles. Mm-hmm. Chris got done. He handed it over to a guy that he believed in. And unfortunately, it went 180 the other way. To the point now that 13 games, I know why you asked that question. How did we get here? 13 games into this tenure that now you're hitting the total reset button. But that would be part of it. I think you have to answer that question. Why with this job? Top three job, west of the Rocky Mountains, everything else. Why did he walk away from it? What is it? What is it? Is it too much pressure? Is it too demanding?
It can't be that. Like, there's almost no pressure.
Well, when Pete Carroll has been in town the last 12 years, there has been none. You've not had to do that. Is it recruiting dynamics are shifting in the conference, and I don't want to play in those waters? I don't want to have to do what I've got to do to recruit some of the caliber of athletes today that other people may be willing to do, that certainly in other conferences they're willing to do. And if I get to New Year's Six Bowl after New Year's Six Bowl and I'm losing to these teams, I don't know if Chris Peterson wants to play in that recruiting pool the way others play. So was that the main charge? I don't think that was the main thing.
Yeah, I'd have a hard time believing that. And it's not a shot at Chris Peterson or anybody else, but it's hard for me to believe the, like, well, I'm the lone honest man amidst thieves.
Right.
Like, it's hard for me to fully buy
into that. No, David Shaw is doing it. David Shaw does that at Stanford.
Yeah, I'm not buying that that's the reason. And I'm not saying that it couldn't have been a contributing factor, but it's hard for me to look at it as the lone honest man amongst thieves. Sorry, that's
probably
not good enough.
Was he Machiavellian enough? Was he bright enough to look at where this road was going in college football and college athletics and go, man, I can't do it? Like, free agency? Transfer portal wide open. The way I run my program, it's going to be hard. I want to develop kids. And at the first difficulty, mom and dad and kid can say, I'm out. Sorry, I'm gone. Did he look at that and know that was coming and say, I'm sorry, you know, I'm stepping away from this? And I've heard that about Herm. And we'll see if that transpires here after this season, that Herm, for the same reason, is like, yeah, man, this job's tough enough. It's hard enough to recruit, you know, junior college kids and high school kids and parents and high school coaches and all of that. And now I got to recruit every one of these 85 guys on my roster each and every year. Cause at any turn, Alabama could come calling, LSU could come calling, Ohio State could come calling and poach my guy. And my best player's out of here. Like, no, thanks. Don't want any part of that. So, did Chris see all of that coming, that this is the direction it was going, and that's why he's out on college football? I don't know. But, Mike, to answer the question of how do we get here, I think you do have to pry at trying to figure out Chris walked away.
Well, and we did some of that. We're never going to come up with an answer, but I gotta be honest, Brock, if I'm continuing to hold your feet to the fire, yes, that's part of the story. But the it's not nearly as important as how they decided to replace him with Jimmy Lake, because ultimately he did walk away. He could have gotten hit by a bus and they would have had to do something.
Yes.
They hired a guy in Jimmy Lake that flamed out in not even a season and a half.
Correct.
The guy never even coached an Apple Cup. He struck at least one player, maybe more. like one that we saw, then lied about it after talking trash in kind of an embarrassing way, and did all of that while running a program that did nothing on the field, took no advantage of the players they had, got worse in recruiting along the way. I mean, you can make an argument he didn't do anything well.
I'd have a hard time disputing that. And what he did, unfortunately, the worst of all of those things you didn't even mention, which is the first and most important job. And I think I say this all the time to you when you hire a head coach. Yeah, who is he going to surround himself with? Right? Who is Pete Carroll? How much conversation have we had about that team in town and your staff and your assistants and everything else? How much have we had about Sark and you know, way back when Nick Holt. Yeah, Nick Holt. And the cast of characters there, and certainly Chris Peterson, folks pretty hard on Bush Hamden and Jonathan Smith and anybody calling plays. And then who does he surround himself with? I mean, I would argue about as difficult and trying and bad a staff as you possibly could. And I did not wear purple and gold glasses and give you a bias when that hire was made. I think I pretty much panned it and was like, that makes no sense.
Which is hard for you. I mean, you thought it was good news when Bush Hamden was let go and when he came back.
Yes.
Jimmy Lake fired Bush Hamden in his first day on the job. Had no use for him. Brought in John Donovan.
And where's then he Bush hires an assistant.
Missouri, I think.
Missouri. And then he hires an assistant running back coach who had been fired at his previous stop that had no West Coast connection. He had no recruiting connection. Hired other coaches on the staff that had no recruiting connections whatsoever. And I think thought he could be Boss Hogg and sell any kid and every kid because of, you know, the pedigree of guys that he recruited and developed and put into the league in that DB room, which is real. And you've heard that from Kevin King and Buda Baker, and all of them have come to his defense, and they loved him as a secondary coach and a developer of that room and that group. But in its entirety and in its whole, coaching his staff, elevating his staff, putting together his staff, and then being the head honcho to recruit the entire team, didn't work.
Is it ego?
Yes.
Is it ego? He just thought he could do more than he could do. He thought that he had a sheer force of will and personality and skills that he could essentially cover up all the other flaws.
You have played me the Pete Carroll sound, and I think every day this week in your conversation with Pete on Monday, when Pete was like, you got to have a clear plan.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? That would not be the fault of Jimmy Lake. You could not use that against him in this court of holding feet to fire, because he would say, I had a clear plan.
Yeah, he did.
I want to hire an NFL guy that was going to run the ball. I was going to play my defense. I'm going to play an NFL scheme. I'm going to do it my way. I don't care what anybody else thinks. I don't care if they thought John Donovan was terrible. I totally believed in him. I believe in my system. I had conviction about how I was going to do this. I had answers for everybody of how I was going to do it. So he actually had a fair amount of humorous with his conviction of how he wanted to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe too much.
Yes.
Right? I mean, maybe too much conviction. And by the way, I can relate to that. Like, I've talked to you before. I mean, that's part of the problem that I ran into in Boston, was feeling like I had such a strong plan of what I wanted to do when I went to WEEI that I wasn't willing to listen to other people. And that was stupid. And in retrospect, one of the major reasons I failed there. So I can, not the only reason, but was certainly a contributing factor. And I can relate to that. I think I know where he's coming from. He probably should have not just listened to the Pete Carroll sound. He should have listened to the Brian Kelly sound. He was on with your guy, Daniel Jeremiah, and Bucky Brooks, and was asked a similar question about what makes a good quality first-time head coach in college football.
I had 19 years of being a head coach before I got the job. That helped. I don't think you could take the job over and not have had some scarring when you got here. I mean, I made a lot of mistakes before I got here, had a lot of successes, but still had some growing to do. And then when I got on the job here, still had to figure out how to do this job. And for me, this job is about balance.
That's Brian Kelly, who's in the middle of a horror film, actually. He's about to, I don't know if you knew, he's about to look
That's
around.
A masked man sneaks behind you.
Yeah, he's about to look around the corner, and you have no idea what's going to be there, as you can tell from the music. But that whole idea of 19 years of making mistakes and learning from it, Jimmy Lake didn't really have that.
No, he did not. Never was. Never was a head coach. Not to say it never happens and that some can have success, but most don't. there's a reason that most broadcasters on the television news start in small markets. There was a certain huge help for me starting on ESPNU and getting calloused and failing and saying stupid stuff and learning. And all of a sudden, you know, I mean, look at homeboy that was in the Monday Night Football booth a couple years ago. Wow. Tony Romo did it. He came right from the field to the booth. Anybody can do it. No, not just anybody can do it. Not just anybody can go from
Witten?
Jason Witten.
Hard hitting Mark Witten. Was that Jason Husky? Oh.
Did I send you? I don't think I sent you this article. A friend of mine that we all know over at Amazon sent me this article, and it was a pretty good one. And Jeff Bezos had done some research, and it turns out Jeff Bezos' opinion is similar to a lot of this research when it comes to leadership. Did I send this to you guys? Mm-mm. I don't think I did. And Kevin sent it to me with a little note. It was after all this went down. And one of the big keys that research has shown for great leadership and success in leadership is something called intellectual humility. Intellectual humility.
Okay.
And I think that that is a huge part of what happened in this story. Jimmy Lake has an enormous amount of football intellect, especially defensively and in coverage and in developing guys and in doing that. I mean, his track record of that is pristine when it comes to that side of the ball and that unit on the back end of it in particular. Running the whole show, thinking he had every answer and the conviction for the whole big picture, he had none of that. And then when you look at the staff that he surrounded himself, he did not surround himself with people brighter, more experienced, previous head coaches, John Donovan, failed coordinator, Bob Gregory, longtime forever linebacker coach, great guy, grinder.
He didn't have his Jeff Tedford.
He did not. He did not have a head coach on staff that could pull him aside and say, Jimmy, psst, don't wear the run the damn ball hat. Not a good idea. Not going to help for Jalen McMillan, who we're recruiting right now, and some of these top-tier guys. Like, well, I don't care. Screw them. If they don't want to be a part of it, that's the way I'm going to do it. Okay. Well, screw them. And guess what? Puka Nacua is the leading receiver at BYU. How did that go for you? Like, you know, I don't think he had any of that sounding board that you have to have, especially as a first-time head coach.
Yeah, it's an interesting challenge as you move up in management and trying to determine when to stick, not blindly, but be incredibly faithful and loyal to your idea of where you want to go, to that identity that you want to build, and when to compromise and realize that you've got to let other people into the world. I think it's a really, really big challenge. I don't know that I ever was fully comfortable with where that works when I was in management, and I'm guessing Jimmy Lake had the same problem. I would argue, though, that one of the bigger problems here is that when you're explaining Jimmy Lake's skill set to me, you're not explaining the skill set of a head coach. Mm-hmm. You're talking about I really don't care about what his scheme is. Cares. Yep. Scheme? Don't come to me with scheme. All the schemes work. When they draw up those plays, they all work. It certainly matters what kind of talent you have running the scheme, but don't come to me with scheme. You're not going to hire a head coach who's got a good scheme. Go hire a coordinator who understands scheme. Go hire some position coaches who understand how to teach that scheme. But your head coach has to be a leader. Has to understand press relations because you're meeting the press. You're the official ambassador from your school. Has to understand managing people. Has to understand leadership. Has to understand, you know, completely the time management, clock management. Yes. All these things that have nothing to do with scheming to win a football game. Correct. That's not to say that it's not a helpful quality to have, and you got to know enough about it in order to rise to that level. But I just can't think of a head coach that's ever been successful because they're the best schemer out there. The only one that comes to mind is Bill Belichick, but he's also the best at all of those other things, so I'm not sure it matters. That's why he's the best coach of all time, is because he can do all of those things better than anybody.
The article was from Inc.com, by the way. Research agrees with Bezos. This is the most important quality for success. And this was a clip from that article that said, quote, to reach your maximum potential, you need to be willing to learn and improve. And that necessarily entails admitting you don't already have all the answers, which is why Bezos and others actually love hiring those who have tried, failed, and learned from their errors. It shows you're open enough to new and contradictory information to be as successful as you can possibly be. Wow. If and when Jimmy Lake gets another opportunity as a head coach, you know, I don't know if that will come after a rehab stop in Alabama as a D coordinator or somewhere in the SEC.
Rehabbing the reputation, not like it wasn't like a Steve Sarkisian rehab stop.
Correct.
Okay, let's just want to be clear for the guys, you know.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Yeah, they call Nick's little incubator down there just a football rehab for those guys to experience it and to be doused in their whole process and everything and then come out of it. And I think Jimmy Lake will have D coordinator opportunities.
Rebirth, it sounds like.
Possibly.
Like a baptism of some
sort. And if he gets a second shot at being a head coach somewhere else, it would be fascinating to see, you know, how he would answer this. Mike, how did we get here?
Yeah.
You know, I don't think he'd point fingers and say, yep, Jen Cohen didn't give me resources. Nope, didn't have tools. Maybe you make an excuse and there's some validity to a crazy pandemic time and recruiting's extra difficult and recruiting the West Coast was a little bit harder than anywhere else and yada, yada, yada. And there are probably some merited explanations there. But I think bottom line is just that humility to realize, especially in hiring your staff as a first-time head coach, you better surround yourself with people brighter than you, more experienced than you, that will challenge you. And I just don't think any of that happened over there on Montlake.
Well, you bring up humility, and maybe you're not a great cook. Maybe Thanksgiving's not for you in terms of like bringing everybody to your house and cooking everything that you want to. Like, maybe that's not the best plan for your family, and it's time to recognize if that is you. And you like to do things that are, you know, good for the community. Let's be clear. Famous Dave's Barbecue Holiday. Buy one, get one's back this year, Brock. When you feed your family this Thanksgiving with Famous Dave's Turkey Dinners, you're going to be feeding another family in need at the same time. For every turkey dinner you purchase, Famous Dave's is going to be donating on your behalf to Northwest Harvest this holiday season. Taking pre-orders now at FamousDaves.com. Dinners include... You ready?
I'm so ready. I'm going to write this down.
I'm going to write it down. Get your pen out.
Okay.
Whole Hickory Smoked Turkey Feast. Talking about hickory smoked turkey, slow smoked over hickory wood for 3 hours, rubbed with a holiday blend of spices. You got to have sage on there, right? If it's going to be holiday,
it's going to be a fall.
Yeah, that's a big fall. That's the biggest fall spice.
You think that's smoked in the ghost kitchen?
I don't think you can smoke anything in the ghost kitchen. Yeah, I think you serve out of the ghost kitchen.
Oh, okay.
All right. I mean,
that's who works in the ghost kitchen, by the way?
Well, that's sort of
you do not want that answer, my man.
The music is playing like the Daniel Jeremiah and
Yeah, exactly. It's podcast. All the time in the ghost kitchen. Cornbread stuffing, 3 quarts. To that, garlic redskin mashed potatoes, Dave's cheesy mac and cheese, and cornbread muffins. That'll feed 12 to 15 people, and it's only $159. So that's like a steal of twice the price for Thanksgiving. You can go a la carte, go just the whole hickory smoked turkey that feeds 12 to 15. It's only $89. And then you can make the sides. I've done that where like I've made like stuffing and some other stuff, but like go purchase the turkey. Mm-hmm. Sliced hickory smoked turkey family style feast available in two sizes. You can go with the 2-pound turkey Texas beef brisket for 2 pounds. How do you feel about that on Thanksgiving, Howdy?
Yes, please. I'll do it anyway.
Cornbread stuffing. Again, the mashed potatoes, the Dave's cheesy mac and cheese, and the cornbread muffins. You can do, if you only have a smaller group, you can do four or five people for $99, or double that, 8 to 10 people for $189. So you got some really like all kinds of options to make Thanksgiving a lot easier if you need to show some humility this year and maybe give up the fact that you're a cook. Or if you just don't want to deal with it, which is kind of where I'm at. That's why I've become a restaurant guy.
And you don't have to deal with the dishes either.
So much better. It's so nice. And then like this is cool because you still have leftovers for this. It's not like going to the restaurant where you don't have leftovers. You still have leftovers.
Best of both worlds.
The best of both worlds. You can celebrate Thanksgiving famously. Pre-order right now. Do it quick at FamousDaves.com. All right, Brock. Well, we held you accountable enough. Maybe it's time that we shift the accountability lens to what's going on with the Seahawks. 3-6. It's unrecognizable that a Seahawks team with Pete Carroll and Russell Wilson, I know Russell hasn't been there for, you know, in some way, like 3 full games plus the game that he got hurt in. Plus, you and I seem to be the only ones who thought the finger was the major problem this past weekend. You know, Pete said it was rust. I talked to Hasselbeck. He said it was rust. The callers just thought it was indecisiveness and decision making. I don't know. I saw a guy who's one of the most accurate passers of all time complete 50% of his passes and miss wide open guys. That, to me, looked like his finger wasn't healthy.
See, I would double down on this. Maybe I'll call Hasselbeck afterward and yell at him.
Straighten him out.
Yeah, that surprises me that he did not agree with that, with you and me on this. Because if Russ had missed like up, down, left, right, one hopping it, I think I would live with rust a little bit more. Yeah, like the game sped up on him. He's just rusty. He's fundamentally all out of whack. The fact that like all four throws just sailed. The fact that when I watched like practice, and it was just little brief clips in practice of him throwing and stuff, but throws were high. I mean, it was the same miss over and over and over. Right. So if it was about rust, you'd be able to correct that. Like, okay, yep, I'm sailing a little bit high. But when you can't, to me, grip it. And of course, Pete's going to say that, as I told you on Monday, like he and Russ, they're not going to make that excuse. But to me, when you miss the same way and that ball sails 3-4 times and he misses high over and over and over and over again, when he almost never does, I'm sorry, man. And we'll see, you know, the proof will be in the pudding Sunday.
Well, maybe,
let's see what the wrap is on his finger. Let's see if that tape or whatever that was is not on his finger. Let's see if he goes to a glove. I mean, let's see.
Or just being 20 degrees warmer should
help. Exactly. It should help. Is there going to be rain and moisture, though, on Sunday? I mean, has it stopped raining in the Pacific Northwest?
Beautiful today, yeah.
Yeah, it stopped raining. We're still underwater from the previous rain.
No, it's nice out there. There's sun out there. Beautiful.
So we'll have a little bit of a tell. If he's wearing the exact same kind of apparatus on his finger, then maybe, you know, there's a little merit to that. Hey, it was just rust. But I'm sorry. When I see those balls sail in the same way over and over and over and over again in ways we have never seen before in his career, I am going to question the grip. I am going to question the tape on his finger or whatever that was on his finger. That, I'm sorry, it just limits your accuracy and control.
It sure seemed that way, and especially when he was on the run, right? I mean, there were a couple of throws, and that's what makes one of the many things. But that might be the thing he's most elite at is his accuracy on the run.
Yeah,
and I didn't see that. I mean, like a few of those throws were on there, and I don't know if there's like a something where it's sort of like it all adds up to having that challenge, but it just didn't look like Russell Wilson to me.
Yeah, and do we expect him to look like Russell Wilson Sunday? I mean, that is the one thing as well in 10 years when he has a clunker. And this was the worst clunker in his career. Maybe not statistically speaking, because there weren't a ton of picks, but there were two. And more than anything, there was a goose egg for the first time in 150 starts. There was 0 points scored in two of those interceptions into the end zone. So, yeah, you may argue this is the worst statistic game of his career. You don't score. Mm. Do we expect to see a rebound against a defense? If we remember last year, that gave him fits at times, that loves to bring the house, that loves to blitz, that loves to put everybody in his face, that feels like they've got some serious athletic dudes that are going to sit in the A-gaps, get right in front of him, make life difficult, blur the picture for him, speed up his clock. I mean, that was the one thing I totally agreed with Romo, is you just can't simulate the speed of this game, and in particular in the pocket. And it's going to take him a little while to ramp back up to some of that speed. He's going to have to ramp up in a hurry, and arguably the biggest must-win regular season game he's played since late December games.
Romo's like, number three is going to have to shake off the rust here. They had number nine in the last couple of weeks, but you think he even knew Russell Wilson's name?
It was. I want to get to them in a moment. I'm going to get to CBS because I
number 12 under center for Green Bay. I think he's been sick, Jim. Could you update me on that? Who is this guy?
What was going on there?
Not a lot was going on there. He was just trying to fake his way through a broadcast that he was entirely unprepared for.
All right, I'll tell you what, then. I dig into it a little bit now. I mean, I do have some rough stuff that I want to talk about, but we can get to that. That idea of the NFL industrial complex, right? And there was a book a couple of years ago that kind of coined the phrase of just like the way the NFL, you don't want to know the way the sausage was made. Mm. Watching that broadcast and then this whole Adam Schefter thing in the last couple of weeks has really like kind of opened my eyes and disgusted me.
So what was Schefter being?
Well, let me start with the CBS thing.
Okay.
You watch the game, right? So yes. they give you the Russ story and they give you the Aaron Rodgers story. The Russell story is this mumbo jumbo about how he's been, you know, rehabbing 19 hours a day and he's the greatest rehabber and okay, fine. Like that.
And he's 4 weeks ahead of schedule.
But that's the thing that truly bothered me. When I have my notes, my need to know that I wrote out from the day after the injury, 4 to 8 weeks. 4 to 8 weeks. When did this become 8 weeks? It was 4 to 8 weeks.
Well, coming back and forth. Well, the doctor really told him 6 to 8.
What the heck?
But Russell knew.
What the heck? Yeah. We heard from the very beginning, 4 to 8 weeks. Now, I do want to talk about why it's important to Russ to change that story, because for the life of me, it bothers me and I can't fathom it. But specifically, Brock, why has CBS changed the story? That wasn't the story. Russ is already a hero. You don't need to make him a superhero. He came back on the short end of the timeline. Great. Why do you have to fake the timeline? It was never 8 weeks. It was never 6 to 8 weeks. It was always 4 to 8 weeks, and he came back in 4. Congratulations. He's tough, and he worked hard. I have no issues with that. Don't lie to me about it. Yeah. And then on the other side, they tell the Aaron Rodgers saga of how he got sick. He said what he said about being
immunized.
Not inoculated. Immunized. Same thing.
Inoculated.
And then he went on the Pat McAfee show and apologized for misleading people. I seem to remember like one other detail. Oh, yeah. The first appearance on the Pat McAfee show. Let me just skip right over that.
Yes.
What are you talking about? Like, oh, well, just completely ignore the most interesting, arguably, part of the story and just skip right to the good part where Aaron Rodgers gets to be a choir boy.
That's what
again?
They want. They want the good part.
Well, fine.
I learned it last year.
The story.
I was, what did you say, inoculated, Howdy? I was inoculated last year.
Yeah.
And immunized with my experience in the NFL, some of which I'm not going to share on the air. But I've told you guys privately of phone calls that I got, like, nope, that's not how we do it. Not how we do it. It's the big, you know, we try to sell to everybody, Mike. It's not going to be negative. If there's a good play, right, in a reception or an interception, whatever, we're going to highlight the good. On every play, there's a good and a bad. Usually, someone does really well or someone gets beat. What do you want to highlight? We're going to highlight the positive. We're going to sell this to as many people as we can. We want to grow.
If I'm Pete Carroll and Darrell Bevell and Russell Wilson, I'd be pretty mad that in the worst moment of my career, nobody chose to highlight the unbelievable play that the opposing cornerback made and instead decided to throw me under the bus for not handing the ball off to Marshawn Lynch, which would have been dumb.
Have you noticed Collinsworth the last 5 years? Have you listened to him on Sunday nights? Have you seen that tone down? About 180 degrees, because I have, because I think that was
fake it, man. Like I get that they have a job to do. I understand that when you're in, you know, they're in bed with the league. I get it, but you still have a job to do. How do you skip over that part of the story? How do you pretend and just change the time? Just lie about the Russell Wilson timeline? It's just not true.
Did you know that he was on the road to amputation, and they were going to have an Israeli cadaver finger?
Really?
Did you know that?
I didn't know about the cadaver finger.
That was left on the chopping room floor. Wow. It was either, hey, we're going to go 8 weeks, or we're going to talk about amputation and the cadaver finger flown in. For those that are like, what is he talking about right now? That was from the fantasy football camp years ago with...
Hold on. I remember it was the Packers receiver.
Yes.
I can picture him. I just don't know if I can come up with his name.
I think it started with a J. I think his name started with Javon.
Javon. Yes. I want to say Javon Curse, but obviously it wasn't that. Javon Walker?
I think it's Javon Walker. I think it was.
I think it's Javon Walker.
Who had some cadaver
licking. He had an Israeli cadaver.
Exactly right.
Yeah. Javon Walker and his Israeli cadaver.
After 20th overall in 2002.
Yeah, that was a Claytonism, right? That was one of the first, like, fool. This Israeli cadaver knee for Javon Walker. Yeah, I do remember that. That was great. Yeah. I enjoyed that whole thing.
Yep.
It looks worse, Brock, when you go through this. Did you see Robert Klemko's thread on this Schefter thing?
No.
I'm pretty bothered by this. I got to tell you. So when the Schefter, remember Schefter got himself in some trouble with the Gruden emails because he went back to Bruce Allen and called him Mr. Editor and stuff. And at the time, hey, I'll own it. I didn't think it was that big a deal because, hey, Adam Schefter's not a real journalist. Like,
he just wants to get his facts right and it's a lockdown.
Maybe.
And, you know,
yeah.
So I didn't really get too bent out of shape about that because it just seemed like it was drawing focus away from the real problems. And certainly the stuff that Bruce Allen said and did seemed like a much bigger problem. But kudos to those people who were right on the story then, because a couple of weeks later, Klemko comes through with the timeline of what happens here with Schefter and his tweets about Dalvin Cook and his girlfriend. Mm. And so essentially, I'm going to try to do it as quickly as possible. Dalvin Cook, before anything happens, Schefter has a tweet saying that Dalvin Cook was the victim of a domestic violence situation.
Well,
he just says Dalvin Cook contends he's the victim of domestic abuse and extortion.
He contends, yeah.
Right. And they get this whole story out there, and, you know, this woman who has been ID'd allegedly broke into his house with a stolen garage door opener, maced him, and then beat him up. His agent explains how she tried to extort him, and there's this picture of her that comes with it when she was in the military, so obviously she looks incredibly able, and how could this woman possibly be abused, etc. And, you know, the next thing that happens, Schefter says, let's see, Schefter's tweet says, Dalvin Cook is the victim of domestic abuse and extortion. There's pending litigation, according to his agent, Zach Heller. So he puts it at the end, but it doesn't start with, according to his agent, it starts with, Dalvin Cook is the victim of domestic abuse and extortion. An incident occurred over 1 year ago when a female U.S. military sergeant, and then goes on to tell the rest of the story of the stolen garage door, etc. Hey, by the way, it's possible that that line of the story is true. I'm not trying to choose one side against the other. But when the rest of the story comes out and the pictures of her completely beat up and her text messages that she has from him apologizing for what happened and this, that, and the other, it certainly looks different. This is not just a story about Dalvin Cook, though, and whether or not he's a domestic abuser. It's a story about, and the Klemko kind of goes through like, hey, Schefter got every piece of breaking news from this agent on Dalvin Cook, from his signing to his draft to this, that, and the other.
Injuries to extensions.
He's always had all of the Dalvin Cook news. And according to Klemko, this was the time to pay the piper. Hey, I've given you these five stories over the years, or whatever the number is on Dalvin Cook. Guess what? I need you to get this out for me. And that's garbage. And that's why this whole thing starts to look a whole lot worse when you're not double sourcing and you're not looking right. You're not doing all the things that journalists are supposed to do. All of a sudden you wind up in this spot where you've completely misled people as to what happened in this story, at least possibly.
Yep.
And Schefter himself ended up apologizing, saying he didn't do his job very well. And he's right. And ESPN at some point, I would think, needs to step in and say, this isn't a bad look for the company. I understand they're in bed with the NFL to an extent, but you can't, like, the whitewashing becomes a major problem for me anyway.
Challenge with partnerships. And I don't mean to minimize that in any way, you know, all of that. But this is the challenge that I felt last year calling those games for the first time in my life. It's like, how should I, you know, approach this? I never feel that way doing college games, Mike. Obviously Fox, we're partners with the Big Ten and the Pac-12 and the Big 12, but I don't have, you know, those folks. I've really, other than Houston Nutt calling me after the fact, because his mom was upset with some of the things that I had said, right? I have never really felt any of that. Hey, an SID calling me after a game or whatever. And I just try to be as fair and as level as I possibly can. And yeah, doing the NFL last year was a little different. It was a little eye-opening. Hey man, you know, this isn't like, there's 32 partners here, right? And it's all one big partnership.
It's all one big business. And there's billions of dollars on the line.
And we're all one big business. Yeah. And we're all selling one big business. And we want, you know, a lot of goodwill sold in that business. And yeah, it's a little different entity. And then, you know, when you get the number one, right? And CBS is number one, man, they sure, there's so many ways to present the Aaron Rodgers story, right? There's so many ways to present the Pete and Russ story. There's so many different avenues that you can take. And we know that doing this job, doing this podcast, but certainly you do every day, Saul, because you write your need to knows.
Yeah.
How do I want to craft these?
Yeah,
how do I want to present these? How do I want to share my opinion on these? And I know you're an opinionist, and you want every analyst to be an opinionist, but not every analyst or play-by-play analyst.
I don't need every analyst to be an opinionist. Just if that's what they're doing for a living, they should offer opinions. But I think what makes this Klemko kind of timeline interesting is he points out that after Schefter did none of the work, right, and then he successfully muddies the water with all the usual suspects, as he says, jumping in to, you know, kind of make it look as if Dalvin Cook is the victim. He says the Star Tribune went and found the lawsuit, which is available on the internet, and images like these found in the filing and the story took a backseat to Schefter's reporting in the larger NFL media landscape. ESPN, a media organization roughly 500,000 times the size of the Star Tribune, with more investigative resources than most police departments, had to cite the Star Tribune in their updated story. Wow. How is ESPN okay with this, he asks, because Schefter's not paid to be a journalist. He's not beholden to journalistic standards, though half the outlets covering the NFL take his word as gospel. Professionally, he's meeting their expectations. Morally, though, he's setting a very low bar. Mm. He goes on from there, and it is worth your time if you go look up Robert Klemko online and on his Twitter feed and look through it. It's not a big deal whether or not Schefter's a journalist when he's reporting who got drafted or who got hurt or who got traded to whom. Who cares? Just a broker of information.
Yes.
But when he starts delving into these other criminal parts cases. Of life, criminal cases, etc., there's no credibility at all. No. And there's no way for us to know whether or not, you know, they're
this is spin or this is news.
Yeah, I really object to it. And then when I see that, like, how many people followed the Aaron Rodgers situation versus how many people watched the game on Sunday? Many more people watched the game, right?
Oh, yeah.
I think people watched the game. And
yeah, it was one of the most watched, like, 130 regular season games in 5 years.
By the way, 2:30 in Arizona just totally screwed me up all day. What a weird time to do anything. But you didn't get any of that. You didn't get any of the real story.
Mm-mm.
That's kind of gross.
Yeah.
And it seems to me, and this is why I wanted to bring it back around to Seattle, it sure seems to me like Russ is playing this game in a way that is unfamiliar and, quite frankly, I think unbecoming. I don't understand what Russell's trying to prove.
Like brand protection mode?
I understand that Russell wants to be known as a tough guy. I understand that he wants to be known as a hero. I understand that he wants to be the guy who's always available. I understand that he's a great winner and a great leader and all those things. And by the way, he's proven it time and time again. But specifically when he had the MCL injury on one knee and a high ankle sprain on the other leg. Unbelievable. He didn't miss a game. He missed like one snap in that entire sequence. It is one of the most remarkable Willis Reed-like incredible performances anyone's ever seen. Equal to Jordan's flu game or Favre after he lost his father. It's incredible what Russell accomplished that year. It was heroic in the football sense. But it wasn't super heroic, right? It was Batman, not Superman. Why does Russell need to prove to us, Brock, that he has some sort of a superhuman ability to heal himself? That's not about.
What year was that? Was that 16?
I think so.
15, 16.
I think it was 16.
I think it was 16, right? 15 was the year they had the massive turnaround after the Super Bowl. I think it was 16, right?
Yep.
Do you remember, Howdy, Kyle? Actually, Kyle, your memory's probably first in this. Do we remember all of the stories then, 5 years ago? I know that he was up in the middle of the night. I remember hearing that.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
But did we hear, like, hey, man, this is supposed to be a 10-week injury. He's back in two. He's working out 17 hours a day. We're posting all.
Specifically, the high ankle sprain. It was like, this guy's playing with essentially a broken leg.
Which is amazing.
The rumors right away came out that he had hired a private medical team
I remember
to take
all
care
that.
Of him around the
and
block.
I thought that stuff was great. I'm not ripping him.
So what is
him.
Different then to now?
Because
why does
he's trying to prove that he can come back faster than you're supposed to be able to. Why? What is the upside? I just don't get it.
Well, not even because faster, I think he, but better.
Right.
Better
That's
than
true.
Ever before.
He even had his doctor say that he was coming back better. The finger would be even better. And then I watched him play, and Brock, you and I reached the same conclusion. He came back too early. He'd have been better off probably waiting another week.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess I don't understand what the goal was. If the goal is to show you're tough, okay, you've done that. The goal seems to be to show that you're better than tough, that you're somehow not human. Yeah. And I'm not sure I understand where that comes from.
Yeah, I don't know if some of this is age, right? And you get to this point, and he's 10 years in. What is he, 34 now, right? Or so some of this is going to start creeping up. How much time does he have left? How much of this is, hey, man, these QBs get injured, right? And that's always been the thing with Russ, like these dual threat mobile guys. Well, take away his legs or all of a sudden he gets hurt. You're going to see him start to slow down. So he wants to cut that off at the pass and say, nope, I'm a superhuman healer. I spend 17 hours a day. I've got an amazing team around me. I'm going to be back. I'm going to be better than even before the injury. So I'm just going to, you know, try to cut any of that negative noise, any of that negative narrative out. But ultimately, I think to your point and what I hear, the only way you do that is 60 minutes of football anyway. You know, like, yeah, those stories are great, but what, you know, 29 million or 25 million or whatever it was, they just watch you play. and, you know, the throngs of Seahawk fans, they just want to watch you play, you know, and you got to go out and produce in a bottom line business.
Do you think he's confused about, like, he thinks what people need him to be is a superhero rather than just to be a hero?
No, I don't think that at all. I think that this feeds into the narrative that he and his camp have been building for years. What's good about the Seahawks? Russell Wilson. What's not good about the Seahawks? Everything but Russell Wilson. And Russell Wilson coming back and doing this thing is all good. Russell Wilson is doing this for the Seahawks. He's the one who's the savior of this organization.
I think you've hit the right word there. Yep. I mean, the word savior certainly comes into it for me. I am really, really bothered by Russ's need to show that he's better than the normal human. Mm. I don't get it. I understand the idea that he has to be tough. I understand that he's a great leader. And there's a million things I love about Russ. I don't understand the need to show that you're better than the normal human is at something that is just a physical, not a mental thing, not dealing with pain, but that your bones heal quicker. What? That's like, that's not even a real thing. I can't fathom what he's going for there.
Well, and he can beat concussions faster with his nanobubbles, and he's got,
you know, there, it is something, I think, a little bit to that position, to be fair. Right? I mean, Ben Roethlisberger wears a size 16 shoe, and it's a different color.
But again, he's trying to show he's tough. Different thing. That's look at me, look how tough I am.
Aaron Rodgers, when he gets hobbled, his calf is bothering him.
Brett Favre, all those guys. That's look at me, look how tough I am. I can play through pain. Russell's not trying to prove that he can play through pain. He's trying to prove that he can heal faster. And that is not a real thing. Yeah. I get the I can play through pain. Hockey players do it all the time. They have a whole reputation built on it. I've never heard a hockey player who manages to come back out after losing seven teeth be like, yeah, I regrow these things immediately. I'm like an octopus. Like, I've never heard that. Oh, yeah, they just regenerate. It's amazing. I have a regenerating tooth.
I would say, to a degree, that, you know, from day one, hashtag no time to sleep, right? Hashtag separations in the preparation, that this is just following in that line. Like, yeah, bro, 17 hours a day. That's what I did to work, right? You heard the broadcast even say that, 17 hours a day. I was up in the, you know, wee hours of the night.
19 hours a day, I'll have you know, because only leaves 5 for sleep. By the way, if he'd slept more, the bones might have healed better.
So, I mean, is it that off-brand? Is it that different than, hey, I just put more work in? I'm more diligent. I've hired a better team. I got a supporting cast. I do put 19 hours a day. There is no time to sleep. The separation's in the preparation. And this is how I've been a cut above the rest. This is how, from a third-round pick, I became a Super Bowl champion. This is how, at 5'10", I broke the barrier, and I'm going to be a Hall of Famer. I mean, is it really, as we talk through this, that much different than his mindset from when he came into this league?
This is Brock and Salk's Blue 88.
Blue 88! Blue 88!
We take you to the field as Brock Huard breaks down three football questions as only he can.
Now here's your hosts, Brock Huard and Mike Salk.
All right, Brock, let's finish up with a little Blue 88. Got three good football questions for you. Haven't done this here in a little bit, so let's see if I can remember how to do it. I ask the question. You answer the question?
I think so, yeah. Or Howdy or Kyle.
Anybody can really answer them. Uh-huh. As long as I do the asking, everything's fine. Okay. Question number one for you, Brock. Chris Carson missing practice again this week. It looked like, you know, maybe it was going to move forward, and then he didn't play in the game, and now he's not practicing. It's a neck injury. It's a spine injury. It's not the same, according to Pete, as what ended the careers of Cliff Avril and Cam Chancellor. But, you know, and I know you're not his doctor. You haven't looked at him. How worried are you that Chris Carson never plays again?
Yeah, I'm pretty worried, man. And you're speaking to a spine guy. You're speaking to a guy whose career was ended. Now, I did not really have a career. I started 4 games. So it's probably hubris for me to call it a career. But at least my time in the NFL that finally shut the door was A physical in Tampa, and B, MRIs of a back that were, you know, as I asked the spinal doctor, who I think still actually consults with the Seahawks, and I said, hey, if I'm John Doe and I just handed you my MRI and you're looking at my back, and at this point I'm 28, 29, how old is my back? And he's like, yeah, it's the back of a mid-50-year-old man. You know, you've got spinal stenosis, you've got degenerative discs, you've got pretty significant issues. And I think this is, you know, just a huge, huge bummer. This is not an ACL. This is not a joint. This is not something that surgery can fix. And frankly, you're playing one of the most violent positions like Cam Chancellor did at strong safety, and your game is predicated upon contact and running through contact. Peyton Manning could come back and play in the NFL after four neck surgeries, Mike, because he could control almost all the contact with his brain, protecting himself, throwing the ball away, you know, ducking in and out of sacks. Chris Carson cannot do that. And for a guy that trains so hard, that prepares his body so mightily, to see this injury, and whether it's stenosis, whether it's a narrowing, whether it's a disc, what, we don't know all the specifics of it. I'll take Pete at his word that it is a little bit different than Cam. He usually doesn't, you know, duck or hide from those things. But whatever it is serious enough to absolutely put his career in jeopardy.
All right, question number two. And by the way, what a shame there. I mean, like, Chris Carson's such a fun guy to watch and such a great story.
We were talking about this off the air. Like,
what a bummer.
How many other teams over the last 10 years? What, I mean, what has it been? 7 years? Six years? That this could be the third star player?
It's not just that it's the third star player. There are three of their more entertaining, fun to watch, good guy stars that we've seen here.
Yeah, it's really, like a humble, a shame. Right? That, you know, Cam had a humility to his stardom. Cliff had a humility to his stardom. Even Carson, right? I mean, he had some charisma and everything, but he too was humble beginnings and a seventh round pick and everything else. And man, I can't think of another team that's had more than one. This could be the third possible one that have to retire early.
All right, as I said, question number two.
Oh, sorry, question number two.
Jen Cohen now has, you know, we talked about the reasons why they are where they are, but what we didn't talk about is what comes next. I know you've given me some names. What's the timeline, and who ends up as the head coach at Washington?
Yeah, I think part of the reason you make this move in season and as quickly as they did from suspension to termination is because they are going to move quick, because there are so many jobs. You texted me earlier this week and said, how many jobs are open on the West? How many could come open in the conference? What does this landscape look like? Yeah, it's a bunch of them. Could be upwards of nearly half of this conference, depending on, you know, what happens with Wilcox and does he entertain some of these offers. But you have to get out ahead of it. And I think Jen and her sounding board, which I've said to you is Chris Peterson, and I think they feel, you know, certainly an enormous sense of urgency that Jen has got to get this right. And I think they're talking now. I think they're moving now. I think they're going to move as quickly as possible, Mike. When you've got the 54th recruiting class, that's where they sit right now in 24/7, 54th. You got to act in a hurry. And oh, by the way, as I said to you at the beginning of this podcast today, it's not even those high school kids. Your own kids need to know. Your own players need to know. Your own young players need to know what the plan is going to be moving forward, so they too can make some decisions and either get behind it or not. So, yeah, I think time is certainly of the essence.
All right, so who's it going to be?
Well, I think the two that I would put at the top of the list are Dave Aranda and Matt Campbell. Two defensive-minded guys. Two guys I think Chris Peterson reveres an awful lot and respects a ton. Two that have had some callousing, that have had now experience for Dave Aranda. The challenge is LSU and USC and a number of these other jobs that may have more resources than you do.
So you've mentioned Dave Aranda a couple times. So he's a head coach at Baylor. He's from L.A., grew up in Redlands, so outside of L.A., actually pretty close to Pomona, but grew up outside of L.A. He's never really coached on the West Coast. I'm surprised.
Yeah, he coached at Utah State. He coached at Hawaii.
So you consider that to be sort of the... So that's enough knowledge for you of kind of what's going on here for him to be a good candidate?
Yes, and he has his brother in L.A. and family in L.A. and travels to California and I think knows this landscape, has recruited this landscape, okay, and is a deep thinker in that whole intellectual humility. He's maybe about as far on that spectrum as you could possibly be. The thing that I loved about him the most, Mike, he was wrong. He got a decision wrong. He became the Baylor head coach. He hired an OC, and there was relationships and trust in that, and made that move, and it was the wrong guy. And after a year, didn't go, well, we got COVID, yeah, I'll just kind of give it another year. He knew it was wrong, and he had the guts to make a move at that position, to swallow his pride and go, yep, got it wrong. And I'm not going to continue to go down this road. I'm going to, another Amazonism, I'm going to fail fast. And I'm going to bring the right guy in, and it's totally rejuvenated their offense. They've become a dynamic team, and certainly an enormous win over Oklahoma proved that last weekend.
And then Matt Campbell?
Matt Campbell would be a guy that I think has done everything he could possibly do in one of the more difficult jobs to to recruit to in Ames, Iowa. And you're, again, talking about a Big 12. I think that's the opportunity this presents versus years past, the instability of where that conference will be. He graduates basically everybody that he's built his success on the last 5 and 6 years. And he is a tough, disciplined, has been a successful head coach, has elevated a program to places it had never been before, and I think would, for the first time, entertain the possibility of not sticking around in Ames.
I'm surprised you don't go with either Jonathan Smith or Justin Wilcox.
I think that those would be the next tier. I think those would be, you know, and that's not to, to slight them at all, but those, you know, certainly a Matt Campbell, a sense of accomplishment, a credibility, a recruiting, a Dave Aranda, just because I think of his acumen and his trajectory of where he's going, would probably put them on a tier just above those two. But if we were to get news after this podcast posts that Justin Wilcox is the new head coach of Washington, you would not hear me diminish that. I think there's a ton of things and boxes of checks. Jonathan Smith, I don't know. I don't know from a charisma, from a reach.
He's having more success at Oregon State than Wilcox is at a Cal.
Yeah, kind of. I mean,
his offense works. That's something.
Well, you also at Cal, I think, have some of the most difficult challenges that you've got to overcome. I think you've got more opportunity at Oregon State.
Which is hard to say.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's kind of crazy to say that out. But those would be certainly some of the names to consider.
All right, question number three then. Because it's not the only job open in the state. Strange year, man. Who do you see heading to Wazoo when this is said and done?
Yeah, I think this is one of the Mountain West coaches, and this is going to be a guy that has to have head coaching experience. This is going to be a reboot over in Pullman, right? That is a senior laden group. Nick Rolovich inherited from Mike Leach a lot of good players, a lot of veteran guys. As you just kind of look at that starting list, and how many players are going to just be moving on from eligibility. And what is to follow is an incredible amount of youth and an experience in recruiting that has got to get better. Recruiting the last couple of years has not been good enough. So I think you're going to see, and there's a bunch of names that have been bantered about in the Mountain West Conference. And that conference has had a lot of success against the Pac-12. But I would think that the Pat Chen would have to hire somebody with some head coaching experience.
All right. Well, there you go. That is today's Blue 88, and that is also going to do it for us today. It's going to do it for us till after the holiday. So hopefully everybody has a great, safe Thanksgiving. My favorite. Love Thanksgiving. Love it. I'm pumped, man. I like a little food.
You've been ready for this for a while.
I love Thanksgiving. It's just such a great holiday. It's all about eating and hanging
out. Okay, so when we come back from all the turkey and all the fixings and all the fun, two things. Are the Seahawks going to be 3-8, and are the Mariners going to have made a move?
The Seahawks are going to be 4-7.
Okay.
The Mariners will have made at least one move.
Because I believe then that puts us taping December 1st.
Okay.
Lockout day in Major League Baseball.
Lockout day.
So when we tape on December 1st, you do expect a Mariner.
They'll have had one move. Yes, they will do something over Thanksgiving. That's my guess. Jerry, there's no way Jerry can sit with that still.
I think they'll make a move. I don't think it'll be the marquee move.
Right, it might not be they get Semien, but I think they will do something of some sort before they get there. So we'll have a lot to talk about. When we get back, we will see you guys after Thanksgiving. Have a great little holiday, and I guess the hay.
Here's in a barn.
See everybody.
Get to the